Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature.
Today's guests on Nature Bats Last are Dr. Sandra Khan and Professor Paul Ehrlich, co-authors of the recently released book titled Jaws, The Story of a Hidden Epidemic. In the book, Sandra and Paul delve into the serious impact of industrialization on human facial structure and health. Sandra, welcome to Nature Bats Last. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
I thought I'd read a piece from the introduction to the book to give our readers a bit of an overview, and then we could get into the story. How does that sound?
Perfect.
Okay. This is a story about a vast and serious epidemic affecting the developed world increasingly over the last few centuries, one that has gone virtually unrecognized. Jaws is about its origins, how it was discovered, and what we can do about it. The epidemic's roots lie in cultural shifts and important daily actions we seldom think about. We just do them automatically. We don't think about chewing, breathing, growing or sleeping, or even the position of our jaws when not eating or talking. Most of these actions we don't acquire as habits. That is, by doing them repeatedly, they are inborn. A newborn exposed to air starts to breathe and cry. A baby presented with a nipple opens her mouth, starts to suckle, and after a bit may reward you with a grin. In the evening, after driving you nuts with screaming, your baby sleeps like a log, no training required. Simple and normal actions, but we argue, if repeatedly done in certain ways, early in life especially, over time can undermine your health and alter your appearance in some surprising ways. If you keep your jaws apart and breathe through your mouth rather than through your nose for a few days, bite your tongue once in a while, or have insomnia for a few nights, you're going to be just fine. On the other hand, if you from an early age develop the habits of perpetually mouth breathing, eating mostly soft foods that require a little chewing, and sleeping restlessly, snoring and squirming through every night, that could lead to a distorted development of your jaws, face, and airway, the passage which air enters and leaves through the lungs, and to serious health problems later on, even to an early death. You would be a victim of a growing epidemic. What a great introduction.
Oh, yeah. Your sound went off.
Oh, I'm sorry. Have you got me now?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Well, the book looks absolutely intriguing. And like a lot of good books, apparently it started over a dinner engagement. Tell me about how that gained momentum from casual talk around the dinner table and now this book.
Well, as we've talked about before on this show, I'm very much interested in conservation problems and other problems of the human predicament. And it turned out that Sandra has equal interests in conservation. In fact, she was working with an NGO in Mexico, where she was born, to preserve jaguars in one part of Mexico. And the Mexican scientist she was working with, Gerardo Ceballos, was working with me on the same problems. And he introduced us, and Ann and I, my wife and myself, and David and Sandra became social friends. And we discovered that we had a mutual interest in fermented grape juice. I don't know if you know any. If you go to Marlboro in New Zealand, you probably can run into some of that. We think of New Zealand every time we get together for dinner, because we always drink a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc to start, and then move to a Pinot Noir from Marlboro also. Anyway, so Susan. So Sandra introduced me to this entire problem, and she's the one to talk about it. She's the real expert on what parents ought to know, which is what the book is really aimed at.
Well, this just shows how important it is for scientists to be broader in their views, because the human predicament really creates a lot of misery for people and communities. And if scientists don't work together and jump outside their fields of interest, then we're not going to be able to address the problems that humanity is facing. And having an evolutionary biologist and an orthodontist that seem like have nothing in common, working together really can address problems, because Paul can help me figure out why these problems are so evident. And what we're considering the problems are the fact that a lot of people have crooked teeth now, a lot of children have to wear braces, and this was not commonplace 50 years ago. And I wanted to know why I saw that this was increasing. And at the same time, I started seeing a lot of children that were starting to have problems with sleeping, where their sleep was interrupted when they stopped breathing. And that, as you imagine, causes a lot of stress. And some adults have this problem, and a lot of adults snore. But now when children start having this problem so early, then that is a sign of alarm. And we should look at it in the different sciences, and parents should be aware of what's going on.
I think you've got really to the core of a big scientific predicament, that so much scientists operate in isolation in their own very narrow fields. And I see it a lot when we talk about the climate crisis that we're all facing. I see the glaciologists talking about how we're going to lose this much ice by this particular year. And they talk about it as if losing the Arctic ice happens in isolation. There's so much habitat that is disappearing when we lose the ice, and that is so fundamental to the marine food chain and the terrestrial one as well. So I really love the idea that you've joined that dot straight from the very beginning of the conversation.
Well, the ice is going away for basically the same reason our chins are going away, and that is we ran this gigantic natural experiment, settling down to practice agriculture. That let us become specialists in various things, led to industrialization, and all of a sudden we have Stone Age jaws that are trying to develop properly in a McDonald's environment. So these things all really tie together, and everybody ought to be interested in this problem, which is one where you can do something by personal action, and the climate and other problems where it's harder to do things personally, except perhaps assassinate politicians.
And drink good New Zealand wine afterwards.
Exactly.
Well, I suddenly feel that for some reason, my own profession, because I'm trained as a dentist, my profession at some point 100 years ago decided that the mouth was really isolated from the rest of the body. So that every other body part is addressed by medicine and medical doctors. And the teeth and the mouth is addressed by dentists that are mostly, our training is more technical than, you know, we have some medical training. In Europe, it used to be that stomatology was a part of medicine. So after you finish your medical training, you could specialize in dentistry, where now in the U.S. and in most countries in the world, you go directly to dentistry. So for some reason, even insurance sometimes covers for your medical issues, but it doesn't cover for your dental issues. And that is a big problem.
Oh, absolutely. Wait till you get an abscess in your mouth and see how much of a medical condition that becomes within a couple of hours.
Well, in our book, we talk fully about
oil. We're getting weird. Try it again.
In our book, we tell a story of a boy that died because of an abscess. Very sad story, but it's true.
Yeah, your long-term health is tied to your mouth and your jaw much more than people think. And this whole problem of the total change in our environment is now showing up in other ways. For example, yes, the wrong jaw development leads to sleepless nights. And there's a building scientific literature on the effects of sleep deprivation. And we're a main cause of sleep deprivation, but so is moving indoors and leaving the lights on all the time. There's recent studies showing that staying indoors leads to nearsightedness and worse problems in the eyes, because you don't get enough chance to look at great distances, or you don't have the right exposure to light. So these things all tie together. And what we're doing is Sandra's starting an institute. We're trying to get everybody to look at the connections and the really big problems. And lack of jaw development is a really big problem.
From the moment you and I talked about this book when we had our last interview, and then I've done my research and been started to read the book, but one of the things that I thought immediately was, I wonder, is this same dichotomy taking place with all of our young children growing up virtually from the very beginning with devices? I read an interesting study where a neck specialist said that she was seeing huge numbers of young children with neck problems that was completely unheard of before. So, you know, from reading this book and the synopsis, what I see is that historically, we've thought that industrialization only punished all the other species on the planet and that we were the benefactors. Now we see from this work, from JAWS, that there's a direct correlation between industrialization and retrograde evolutionary development.
Sandra introduced me to the problems of posture in your mouth. Tell them about that.
Well, we have posture in our bodies. We are, you know, crooked, looking at devices with our neck forward. From a very early age, we're going to develop in this way. And that will, you know, have damaging effects on our body, on the health of our spine. But our mouth has posture too. So the correct posture, we consider that the lips have to be together. We have to breathe properly and comfortably through our nose only, because our nose has certain functions that we should not really bypass. It cleans the air, it warms up the air, it moisturizes the air, it adds important chemicals like nitrous oxide, that it's antiseptic. I mean, if we have our mouth open, that is a bad posture. And if we hang our mouth open for whatever reason, because we were not breastfed enough, we don't have the strength in our muscles, or because we're living indoors and we have allergies and we cannot comfortably breathe through our nose, for whatever reason, we have a bad mouth posture, which is open mouth, hanging jaw, then we are not going to develop properly. And the faces will grow back and down. And that's when we won't develop the size, the ideal size to fit all the teeth. And the first casualties are the wisdom teeth, which almost everybody has to have pulled because we don't develop big jaws like hunter-gatherers used to. But then now we have not only the wisdom teeth, now the regular teeth are getting crowded. So now we have to have more teeth taken out. And this is only creating a worse problem.
You know, when you don't have enough room in your jaw for your tongue, when you lie back and go to sleep, the tongue tends to slop into your throat and block your airway. And, you know, there's nothing quite so stressful as being awakened by choking in the middle of the night. And that turns on an entirely different system. It stops you from growing. It stops, if you're a child, it stops you from consolidating your memories. It makes it more difficult for you to operate either in school or on the job the next day. And the stress is connected with increases in heart disease, increases in cancer, now even increases in Alzheimer's disease, ADHD, depression, and actually because of the sleep interruption, it makes a higher chance of you being killed in an automobile accident. It turns out that sleep deprivation causes more fatalities in cars than drunken driving. So it's a huge, huge problem, which I have to admit, Sandra turned me on to it. I missed it entirely. I'm an evolutionary biologist. I watched all these changes, and it never dawned on me, why the hell have we got wisdom teeth? I mean, and what's wise about them?
I have a niece who, my Colleen, she's my brother's daughter, and she has a business in Australia called Infant and Child Consultancy, and one of her specialties is sleep apnea. So I've sent a copy of the book to her, and she will read it and come back to us and give us some feedback about where she thinks it fits into her specialty.
She, by the way, one of the very best practitioners in this area is Dr. Simon Wong, who's in Australia in a little city called Melbourne. I'm a Sydney sider myself, but you've probably heard of Melbourne.
And we do have practitioners in Melbourne and in New Zealand also, I think in Auckland. And they follow what we do. And for some reason, there's a lot of interest in the breathing and the airway issues in Australia. Several very big practitioners in that area. I think they're a little bit ahead of the U.S. in just understanding that we're all connected. Our health has to have to connect different parts of our body.
Tell me, with regard to your research and discovering this development, is the situation getting worse in a linear manner, or is it getting worse exponentially as time goes on?
I mean, I think it's exponential, because if we think about, you know, hunter-gatherers and then the development of agriculture and then how the changes started little by little, but then industrialization came, and we are just getting more and more industrialized. So if we can see 100 years ago compared to, you know, 1,000 years ago, there is a smaller change. But then from 100 years ago to now, there is a bigger change. And from the last 10 years, I think we've developed since the time I had my children. My son was 17. We didn't have a lot of the foods that I see young children having now. My kids were weaned into soft foods, but they didn't have those packaged vegetables that were basically liquid that kids are just suctioning, and they don't even move their muscles.
And smoothies. Unfortunately, the nutritional literature looks at the chemical composition of the food. We found, working on the book, we could find almost no systematic studies of how tough foods were at various times, how chewable during time. You look, my colleague Richard Klein, who's the world's greatest evolutionary paleontologist on people, said he's never seen a hunter-gatherer skull which had crooked teeth. Daniel Lieberman, another great scientist in that area, says the same thing at Harvard. If you look at skulls from a cemetery in Scandinavia just a couple hundred years ago and compare the jaws with skulls of modern Scandinavians, there's all in that short time, much too short for any genetic change, there is a shrinkage of the jaws. And I think it's exponential too, for the very reasons that Sandra is. First of all, human population is growing almost exponentially, so there are more people suffering from it, more people getting industrialized, and more money being made by processing food that really shouldn't be processed, that should be eaten either just cooked or raw. And smoothies are a good example. We've selected fruits to be very soft. So you could almost, at least where I live, you can almost get peaches you can drink or pears that you can drink. The only fruit that we standardly get in our family anyway that really requires chewing is apples now. And of course, there's applesauce, there's apple juice, there's all the smoothies. We're not using our jaws. What the hell would kids look like if you didn't let them walk until they were 12? I mean, most of us spend time exercising our muscles so they develop right and do the right job, except for our jaws. As Sandra points out, somehow the mouth isn't part of the body.
I'll tell you a wee story that I saw on a bus in Tanzania many years ago. There was a woman sitting beside us with a baby who would have been about 18 months old, I think. And the mother got a mango, and she worked the mango in her hands, pushing it gently and crushing the fruit within the skin. And she did that for about 10 minutes. And we watched, captivated. We thought, what on earth is she doing? And then she nipped a little top corner out of the top of the fruit and gave it to the baby. And we watched that baby over the course of about half an hour suck all of the juice out of the mango and then bit by bit to peel the mango and pulverize and chew every last bit of the fruit. That child ate up an entire mango in front of us. But first of all, she drank the fruit and then she pulped and ate the rest of the fruit itself. It was really quite spectacular to watch.
There is something very interesting about that process, because when you open any type of fruit and you juice it, immediately as it has contact with oxygen, it starts oxidizing. So the fact that the baby sucked it directly from the fruit kept it from becoming oxidized. So the nutritional value of the same mango, just because of the way it was worked and the time it took, because this baby, even though it was sucking, it had to probably use its hands, its eyes, you know, it's all developing neurologically, the hands, the eyes, the coordination, the sucking, the squeezing. There's so many functions of this baby. I mean, your sister, you said she's in the early treatment of babies. This is an amazing thing that we can incorporate in feeding our children, because if we give them all this, the time that it takes for this baby to finish a mango, as opposed to the same mango, same chemical content, we put in a blender and we give it to them and they suck it in a few seconds, as opposed to really squeezing the glands and the saliva that comes out and the enzymes that come into the saliva that start the digestion of the food in the mouth and the muscle action, all this will make the baby healthier.
Something that I learned in writing the book that stunned me is I didn't realize how much more nursing exercises the jaw muscles than drinking from a bottle does. Actually, one of my good friends knew all about the nutritional value of breast milk and pumped her own breast milk, but she was a working mother, and so she left the breast milk in a bottle for her husband to feed to the baby. And she later realized that that wasn't the best way to go, didn't you?
Uh-huh. Well, I think what the story with the mango, what it reflects is how much historical and evolutionary knowledge indigenous people have that with industrialization we have turned our back on and ignored, to our peril and to our own loss.
Yeah, we just assume that it's got to be good. And now, I mean, again, I'm much more conscious of this when Ann and I, in our old age, eat out a lot because Ann gave up cooking when she turned 80. We look around and A, people are hanging their mouths open, and B, it's almost impossible to order anything in a restaurant you got to chew. Think about it. We're going to be hated by parents. How are we going to be hated by parents? Tell them.
Well, we're going to recommend chewing gum, hard chewing gum for kids.
It was one of the points that I was going to ask, because that's sort of something that's gone out of fashion to a large extent. If you went back to and your youth, Paul, chewing gum was endemic. Everyone was chewing gum.
I smoked and chewed gum. Fortunately, I gave up smoking. I also gave up chewing.
One of the stories that I find most fascinating in our book is the story of George Catlin. Because there was a book written in the 1850s, almost 200 years ago. And George Catlin was a lawyer that was commissioned to live with the Native Americans and find out why they had lower child mortality than the whites in the 1850s. And he lived with the Native Americans for several decades. And when he returned, he wrote a book, and he titled his book, Close Your Mouth, Shut Your Mouth, and Save Your Life. So it was so important to him that the biggest difference between the Native Americans and the whites was that the Native Americans kept their mouth closed. And he describes that the whites used to be, the Native Americans used to call the whites not only pale face, but also black mouth. So the whites had their mouth open all the time. And he tells the story that midwives with the Indians would teach the mothers to, when they remove the babies from the breast, to close their mouth lightly for a few seconds and teach their newborns to hold their mouth open. They lived outdoors, and they had practically no child mortality. They lived better.
Fascinating. I cannot wait until my nieces read this book and then we get to talk about these issues together. It's really quite amazing that people were seeing these things so long ago. An example in the climate environment is that the first real lecture that I know of that was given about climate change was by George Perkins Marsh in 1847. Okay. You know, it's not as if these things are new knowledge. It's actually knowledge that we'd lost and we're trying to recover.
Yeah, his book, Man's Role in Changing the Face of the Earth, if I recall correctly. He had a lot of foresight on these various things. There are slowly, I mean, after all, orthodontists are great people. They want to make people better off, and they work very hard at that. But they're a victim of this siloization, as we call it, of academia, where everybody is in their own little department. And just think about it. I mean, I teach at a little university called Stanford here. It's the best university in the world, but its departmental structure was developed by an old friend of mine named Aristotle. I don't know if you ever you know, you can't think of a present human problem that could be solved in a standard and a single standard university department. And more people are realizing that, and orthodontists are beginning to move in the right direction. There are ones who call themselves airway-centric orthodontists, and they are paying a lot of attention to the fact that much of orthodontic treatment moves the jaws back. By the way, the upper jaws are movable also, the so-called maxilla, which constructs the airway. You're sort of choking people when you do that. And so there can be progress. And we, you know, the book is a nonprofit book. All the money that comes from it, if there is any, and we've only sold 3 copies so far, but those 30 cents are going to go to Sandra's institute and mine that are trying to change these problems. And so,
Sandra, do you think that you'll get much pushback from the industry because they might think that it might curtail the amount of braces that will be used?
Well, the question should be which of the industries, because we're going to be hated by the processed food industry, by the baby food producers, by the surgeons that make a living out of, you know, taking out the wisdom teeth. The orthodontists, they make very good living by, you know, straightening their teeth, which is dealing with just a symptom. And then if things get crooked again, then they get to make money again the second time around. So it's going to be a while for the profession to come around. But like Paul said, it's really, we're realizing, because people get into healthcare, either dentistry or medicine, or like your knees in the early development, we want to help people. And we've been trained very compartmentalized, but we are realizing that we need to change. We need to work together and create a different system. And, you know, prevention is really much easier than treatment. It might not be monetarily as lucrative for the practitioner or for the industries, but prevention is always going to be better. And we need an army of parents to go out and demand that their children are treated early before the symptoms appear, so that the symptoms never appear. So that, you know, we look into curing the problem as opposed to just maintaining the situation.
I'm really scared of Lamborghini and Lexus and Mercedes, because they're really going to get after us, because, of course, they're supported almost entirely by oral surgeons. who buy their cars, taking out wisdom teeth. And as we cite in our book, many of the wisdom teeth removals are totally unnecessary.
But this is backed up by serious research that has looked at the situation.
Yeah, well, we have...
Now go on.
I was just going to say we have about 400 scientific references because we want to inform mothers, but we want to convince practitioners, universities, and so on to change curricula and make it a lot easier for people to get the appropriate advice and treatment.
I always make the joke when I book my dental appointments that I'm going in to make a payment on my dentist's new BMW or Mercedes. It's that sort of standard joke that we all think. But I think you made a point about how siloed the university environment is. And it's so oriented, like a whole education system now is oriented around punching out cogs in the wheel of industrial civilization that is grinding the living planet into dust. It's extraordinary how our children's education have been oriented around the, you know, probably one of the worst things that's ever happened to the planet.
Yeah, well, we are facing existential threats. That is, most of my colleagues think there's a high probability of civilization collapsing in the next few decades, and yet our universities have not changed their approach. For instance, you can get all the way through Stanford University without knowing where your food comes from, short of the supermarket, without being able to describe how climate change is going to affect our lives and how it's going to particularly affect our food supplies. Doesn't mean there aren't brilliant people here, and if you pick the right courses, you can learn those things, but everybody doesn't learn that. They should actually be learning it in junior high school and high school, but they aren't. And by the way, there's a lot can be done in schools on these JAWS issues. We're working with people at Stanford to change the dormitory food so we hopefully get more chewable food and so on. So there's lots of places people are willing to work on this, and people like you are doing a good job of informing people about it. So there is some optimism.
When I read the synopsis of the book, I chuckled to myself and I said, that bloody Ehrlich guy, he really likes poking people and provoking. So many of your books have been challenging the dominant culture in so many different ways. And, you know, you and I go on about extinction all the time. And, you know, that is so uncool, Paul.
It's not only uncool, it's desperately important. And we are actually with Gerardo, the person who introduced us, just was elected to the U.S. National Academy of Sciences as a foreign member from Mexico because of the work he has done on extinction, in theory, what we need to do. And also, he's preserved more biodiversity than any other scientist I know working in Mexico, putting aside land, and does a much better job than the United States on this. But of course, the Mexican government is a lot more educated and smart and, you know, good than the U.S. government, where we now have a cacistocracy, you know, governed by the most criminal and ignorant of people in the country.
Never compare two people at the very back of a very long queue as being one better than the other. I spent a little bit of time in Mexico, and that's 25 years ago, and it looked like a failing state then. And it looks like it's getting closer and closer to being a failed state on the border of another failed state further north.
Yeah. The trouble is we're all going to move to New Zealand. And at least you got rid of the worst of your premiers.
Yeah, well, time will tell on that. The jury is out on our latest prime minister. She comes across very well. She's very well dressable. But the same woman worked in the office of Tony Blair in the UK, who murdered over a million people by lying about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And she's back in New Zealand and has never once said a bad word about her former boss. So I'm particularly suspicious about that.
Well, I think we got to remain suspicious of all our leaders.
One of the things that my father, much to my mother's chagrin and dismay, he used to drum into us kids, question everything, question everything. So, of course, when we question everything, Ma got sick of it.
Well, the again, we might be paid agents of the chewing gum industry or something. So the thing for people to do is, A, get the book, and then, B, any statement in it you want to check, you can find out where the science is. So it is true. Question anything. That's what scientists do. You cannot make progress in science, personal progress, or satisfy your ego by claiming that the world is spherical. You got to come up with something different, because many people do believe the world is spherical. But do you have trouble hanging on down there on the bottom?
I've done 16 ocean passages on small yachts around the planet, and I have failed to fall off in all that time.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm a great fan of New Zealand. I haven't been back for a couple of years, but when it comes to what you chew, what I love is Stewart Island, but I just discovered that their oysters, which I loved and lived on when I was there, are not very chewable. So I think it's time for New Zealanders to start developing a chewable oyster industry, because it's great food.
That's how industrial civilization works, isn't it? You know, you've got to come up with a new idea, a new iteration of the same old bullshit. Okay. I don't know if you're aware of it, but we have an unfolding disaster in New Zealand at the moment called kauri dieback disease, where our iconic massive kauri trees, some of them are 1,000 years old, have all developed this new disease that's killing them. And in the local forest near where I live, there's a rahui now, which is an indigenous ban on going in there to try and stop spreading this disease. So a lot of the things that you've loved so much about New Zealand are completely and utterly under the cosh as we speak.
Is it an imported disease? Do they know?
They don't know. No, they don't know. They haven't identified it exactly yet.
Well, of course, one big thing in the extinction crisis is we move things around so much that we introduce organisms to environments where other organisms have no evolved protection to them. So one of the causes of a lot of the population extinctions is introduced organisms, which are put in the wrong place by human action. And that's what you're seeing here. For example, we've lost many of the bat populations in the northeastern United States. And most people would say, what the hell, who cares? We're lacking some bats. They won't make nests in your hair or something like that. But of course, they're enormously important in mosquito control. And one of the things that's happening in the U.S. Is that mosquito-borne diseases are exploding, Zika virus and things like that. So when you wipe out bats, you're wiping out one of the really important ecosystem services that nature provides us with. When you change all your fruits to ones that you can basically drink, you're wiping out an ecosystem service, a provisioning service, which gave us foods that our jaws were adapted to. So it's all one big hideous mess. And we have, to match it in the United States, a political hideous mess of people who haven't even begun to understand any of the issues. Not that
one of the things I worry about your political leadership is the evangelical nature of it, and those people aspire to a rapture. It looks to me like they've got their foot on the rapture accelerator pedal.
I think they do. What I find even more disturbing is they're really hypocritical, because we have a president, I put it in quotes, president, who is behaving in all the ways they claim to hate, and yet they still support him. And he's winning the war on the environment. He's winning the war on women. He's winning the war on toxics, making them worse in every possible way. The guy who runs his environmental protection agency is actually an environmental destroyer, probably the most important one in the United States. I hope you're doing better in New Zealand.
We're not. We purely and simply not. There's a myth about New Zealand being clean and green. And that's turned into a advertising slogan. And like most advertising slogans, they're either a complete lie or they're a misrepresentation of the truth. Almost all our rivers now are toxic and suffering from phosphate saturation and having algae blooms. I make the gallows-humour statement that one of the only benefits of my mother and father being dead is that they don't have to bear witness to watching that unfold. Because my dad talked about this stuff to me when I was a child. He said things like, in your lifetime, son, a bottle of water will cost more than a bottle of petrol. And we mocked and ridiculed him.
Yeah.
Now, if you go to a gas station, the bottle of water in the chiller fridge inside is the same price as the petrol in the pump.
And it may very well change. And, of course, the nice thing is that the bottle of water in the plastic is absorbing toxics, which you get. You examine a New Zealander's blood now or an American's, it looks like the shelf list in an organic chemistry lab. We're toxifying the whole planet. It all comes back to us. For instance, there's now thought to be a greater weight of plastic crap in the oceans than there will be of fishes. And the plastic gets ground up into tiny, tiny little beads, and they get coated with persistent organic pollutants. And they're small enough that when you eat them in the fish that have gotten them from the food chain, they get into your brain. And there's a lot of people who think we're actually dumbing down humanity, that the IQ of people around the world is dropping. I didn't see any empirical evidence of that until the Republican presidential debates in 2016, which convinced me that our IQs are really going down. And the issue that Sandra and I are facing is, how do we get people to react to all of these problems, and particularly to the JAWS problem, which is one you can actually fix? I mean, what the hell can you do if your sister is threatened with climate change? All you can do is take political action, try and get better politicians and so on. But look at all the things you can do to protect your kids' health, not just from the JAWS problem, but also from many of the other medical problems, like the ones at the spine, from looking at the devices all the time, like the quality of your food. Look at the epidemic we're having of diabetes, which is, again, something that we know how to prevent, but we don't prevent it. Instead of taking care of the JAWS, we're putting people on my daughter is on a CPAP machine. Tell them what a CPAP machine is. I can't ever remember.
Well, if you know anybody that has sleep apnea, which is when they interrupt their sleep by choking, the treatment for it is to wear a mask. It's called a CPAP, continuous pressure machine, so that the air is pushed and is able to go through the closed or the blocked airway into the lungs. They have to sleep with a mask. It's not a really nice way to live, but it's better than, you know, having lack of oxygen. But a lot of children are now having to wear this mask, and it's not a way to grow up.
I mean, it's just preposterous. By changing our diet and going back to the way we always nurtured our children, we could fix the problem. Instead, we're putting these very expensive and complicated machines on them to keep them from choking in the middle of the night. I mean, talk about prevention versus cure. But of course, chewing gum is cheaper to manufacture than machines, I guess.
It's the quintessential industrial civilization response to come up with a piece of high-tech equipment that only the world's top 2 or 3% of the population can afford to have. Well, so, it's the same old story of the whole thing is just distorted in every way, shape, or form.
Well, it's just like geoengineering to solve the climate problem. They're going to get battleships to shoot their 16-inch guns continuously for the next 50,000 years lofting crap into the atmosphere to screen out the sun's energy. It's, you know, these technological cures, people always think they can bring a technological hat, pull a technological rabbit out of the hat to save us. They never realize how nasty the rabbit's droppings are likely to be.
And then you have stirrers like that Ehrlich guy who says that industrial civilization will collapse within a decade. And what we know is that when they start doing all that lunatic geoengineering, that the minute you stop it, you compound the problem even more.
And
it's exactly the same with the collapse of industrial civilization. A lot of us were advocating for that a long time ago, before I understood the threat of global dimming. And there's so much pollution in the atmosphere that's filtering the solar radiation that's coming into the planet, that when collapse takes place, all that dimming falls out of the air and we get an immediate spike in temperature.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a predicament. It's not a problem. It doesn't have a solution that we can look for and throw at it.
Well, you got to remember the biological laws of thermodynamics. You can't win. You can't break even. Things are going to get worse before they get better. They're not going to get better, and you can't get out of the game. A cheery little note.
Voila. Oh, no, this show's not about cheering people up. It's about wising people up. I'm not here to placate people and give them a good time story. All I want to do with my guests is to get the story out and have a debate. No one wants to talk about the extinction crisis. I'm frowned on in my circles because I want to talk about it. But I want to pay homage to those amazing species that we're losing. And people like you and Jacques Cousteau have really instilled in me a passion for biodiversity and for the ecology of the planet. I study the silliest little things. I have cobwebs on the outside of my house, and I have our native birds coming and stealing the spiders from them and stealing their prey. And I take huge amounts of interest in watching that unfold. And the fact that I know that it is all in danger has enhanced that for me. So I think that you can actually take a lot of positiveness out of this extinction story, and you can embrace it more. There's an interesting article came out in The Guardian last week by Maya Hillman. Did you see that article?
I think I heard about it. Tell me what it said.
Okay, he's talking about that the human race is doomed, and that, I'll quote a little bit of it. He says, without hope goes the truism, we will give up. And yet optimism about the future is wishful thinking, says Hillman. He believes that accepting that our civilization is doomed could make humanity rather like an individual who recognizes he is terminally ill. Such people rarely go on a disastrous binge. Instead, they do all they can to prolong their lives.
Yeah,
so that's a little bit of a synopsis from the story.
Well, there's an interesting thing people can think about. There's a philosopher named Scheffler who asked the following question where there's not a clear answer, but for something for people to think about. If you knew when you died that the universe would end, would that change your behavior?
Whoa, that's a deep pool to be diving into.
That's one to stir around with for a while. Well, you know, there are huge ethical issues here, which we're all dealing with in one way or another. I mean, Sandra and I could both live quite happy lives without trying to save the world and not work hard, not get up at the crack of dawn to do various things like radio shows. We're not at the crack of dawn now, but we do get up at the crack of dawn to do radio shows to convince people to change their behavior and so on, because we feel an ethical commitment to our kids, if nothing else. And for me, not for Sandra, but for me, I have great grandchildren to consider. And many people think that there's a big ethical issue in whether we should be wiping out the other organisms that we share Earth with that are the only known living companions we have in the entire universe. you know, is it right for me to deny the opportunity or to not work hard to give my great-grandchildren and their great-grandchildren a chance to go to Africa and see lions and elephants and things like that? And I think there's a huge ethical issue there. After all, ethics are just decisions made by human beings on what's right or wrong. And it's clear that many hundreds of millions of people think it's wrong to wipe out other species. And so I think we have a real ethical charge there. And it's wrong to not treat our children correctly, not raise them correctly, not pay a lot of attention to what we're feeding them and how they're chewing and how they're holding their mouths and so on. Because if we don't, they're going to suffer and their parents are going to spend a lot of money, probably not very wisely, on trying to fix things that never had to go bad.
I think we have a moral obligation to do what we're doing, to talk truth to power and point at the elephant in the room. On Friday of this week, I'll be speaking at a school on the outskirts of Auckland called Deep Bush School. And it's an alternative school. Oh, let me get the exact name of it. Deep Green Bush School. It's an alternative school where obviously alternative parents have sent their children, and the academia is only a small part of the education system there. They're living in a holistic environment and they're doing holistic things. And these, the directors of the school have asked me to go and speak, which what I found was completely intriguing, because most people want me to shut the fuck up.
I know the feeling. A number of people have said, Ehrlich, once you hear, you know, here's the book. By the, can I use the product? Hold.
Absolutely. Take your hand. That's it. Absolutely.
Get it by going to Amazon and looking up Kahn and Jaws, K-A-H-N and Jaws. But they say, yeah, they say Ehrlich wants you to keep his mouth shut. Why doesn't he keep his mouth shut? What the hell? You can't win. But anyway,
I just want you to know we're sort of getting a little bit close to the end. We've got five more minutes. But what I would like you to know is that I've been following your work pretty much all my life. I've been reading your books, and I want you to know it. You've turned me into the guy who won't shut the fuck up.
I'm glad. I'm particularly proud of people that I've helped to become more blabber mouths. I'm even sitting next to one right now. We did a program that started by the woman who was the NOAA, in charge of NOAA in the U.S. government, the Atmospheric and Oceanics Administration, Jane Lubchenco. And she, along with Steve Schneider and myself and some others, started a program which went for a long time training mid-range scientists to talk to the media. And we need much more of that. We've got to get scientists out there who are willing to talk and willing to be advocates. This crap about scientists should just tell you the facts and you draw the conclusions. If a scientist spends 50 years studying climate change and comes to some conclusions, I want to hear what he or she has to say about what we ought to do about it. I wouldn't want them being accused. It's like saying that a doctor who tells you not to smoke is an advocate, and that's the wrong thing to do. So,
but we also have to enlist the scientists that are independent, that are not being paid by a certain industry, which is increasingly a problem.
Well, I think scientific reticence at this stage is bordering on malpractice. We're in such a crisis. There's so few scientists who are prepared to talk about the level of the crisis. I think that is really it's a dereliction of duty, and it's a failure to follow precautionary principle.
Amen. I couldn't agree more.
Hey, look, I'll just tell our listeners that is when you and I had a chat before, and I talked about your other book, The Annihilation of Nature, that you co-wrote with Anne and Gerardo Ceballos. You said that you'd be prepared to come back on the show and we talk our way through that book. Is that still a go?
Yeah, because a lot's happened since, and we've As I said, Gerardo was just elected to the U.S. National Academy, partly because of work that he's been doing on extinction. And so I'd be delighted to come back anytime.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And Sandra, thank you for your time and for the amazing momentum you have given this story by sitting down with Paul and coming up with this wonderful book. I thank you both so very much. And on that note, I think we'll say Nature Bats last and hand it over to the studio.
Gonna get you. Mother Nature.